Palestinian activist in the 1970s. Aviva's work, I think, is an important historical window into collaboration between state intelligence agencies, particularly looking at the governments of France and Germany and also the UK in the context of the targeting and killing of Palestinian activists in Europe, Western Europe particularly, in the 1970s and into the 1980s. This is a really meticulously documented and researched book that I think is important work to consider at this time. This is my conversation with historian Aviva Gutman for Free City Radio. Aviva, your research work seems to point to a really important trajectory between the present and the past in terms of Western European security agencies working deeply with the intelligence agencies of the Israeli state for a particular means, which is repressing Palestinian organizations working in diaspora contexts in Europe. And I came across your work and I felt it was really important to try to create a little bit of a through line between the present and the past. I think that there can be some narratives that sort of adopt this discourse that present the last few years as an anomaly and as something that is really just sort of emerging. But there's a whole historical context and your work points to that. Most importantly, I think there are some parallels between the sort of apparatus of repression that you address with other elements that are concerning also the domestic repression of activists. I mean, in the UK, there's been a lot of important revealings of the ways that climate justice activists were facing the infiltration by state agents indirectly into the group, including in romantic relationships. The late scholar Aziz Chaudhry addressed some of these points in Activists in the Surveillance State. Thanks so much to you, Aviva, for taking a bit of time to talk about your work. Maybe you could just first start with an introduction about yourself, and then just speak about why you embarked on this research and why you feel it's critical and important at this time and in this context.
I kind of gotten interested at first through terrorism. I think what you mentioned, you know, that it's not a new phenomenon. I think you're right. You can look back in history and see how a lot of the developments have actually started way before, let's say, 9/11. And I was starting to look at the reaction of European governments to this new, this what they perceived as new threats of Palestinians using the tactic of, you know, terrorism or, as you also mentioned, it's not just limited to them, it's limited also to all kind of left-wing activism. So it's I'm looking at the reaction of the government to these kind of perceived threats and especially the level of international cooperation. So I'm not looking at what happened on the national level, but I'm really looking at how did this change the international relations of the secret state? How did intelligence agencies realize, okay, we have to... we will not be able to address that issue by ourselves. We need to have a learning process. We don't really understand these groups, really. We want to multiply our forces by sharing intelligence, by meeting up, by having shared and combined training sessions. And this is what I really looked at also from a democratic oversight perspective. You know, these intelligence agencies, they were working together on a completely informal level, and they have resisted any type of oversight up until today. I mean, the European Union has tried to create a more formalized intelligence sharing framework, and the intelligence agencies, no, we want to be able to share intelligence with the Israelis so that nobody knows about that. If it was a formal entity, then that might not be possible. We want to be able to keep things secret from Arab countries, for instance. We want to not have we don't want the public to know what kind of information that we are sharing and how much information is being shared about people. And I think here again is a parallel between the 70s and today. The amount of data that was shared in the 70s is staggering. We didn't have computers at the time to the same level that we do have today, and we can only imagine today. It must be enormous. That was my original frame of research. And then I started looking at, okay, intelligence agencies, they have a link to one another. They have direct connections. They're almost having their own foreign policy, it seems. And then I was linking that to what the Israelis were doing, right? Assassinating Palestinians in Europe if they had any known or believed connection to the Munich Olympics attack, or if they were believed to prepare future attacks. And so then I was genuinely intrigued by the question of, did the European intelligence agencies change their behavior towards Mossad and Shin Bet, the two main Israeli intelligence agencies, when they knew that the information that they would be sharing with Israelis could and would be used for their assassination campaign? And I was very surprised that nothing had changed whatsoever. They continued. I think one insight, is one of my favorites, if you want, of my book, is that it led to kind of an absurd situation where the murderers were being updated about their own murder investigation. Namely, after every assassination, the different intelligence agencies say assassination happened in Paris. So the French DST would share a police report about all the findings that we currently know about this assassination with the whole group of intelligence agencies to which Mossad was participating. So for Mossad, this was important on two ways. One, of course, it learned how to be more careful next time. For instance, there was a bystander who was able to write down the license plate of the vehicle that was used to escape after the assassination. So they probably learned, you know, they have to be more careful with this. But I think on a more important level, the French were signaling to Mossad that they would look the other way, you know, by sending the investigation of the assassination that has been committed by Mossad. They're basically saying, we will not look too deep into this affair. You may go on with what you're doing. We will. It's like a don't ask, don't tell, but it signals a certain tacit support, I would say.
This underlines a lot of the deep structural issues around the gap between discourse and action on the level of state agencies. So Western labeled discourse around due process and, you know, the rule of law, etc., which, I mean, since October 2023 has really been brought into question because of the scale of injustice taking place in Palestine today. However, I think that it's always important to think about things in a trajectory and not in isolation. So I'd love to hear your thoughts about that sort of gap between the sort of public-facing discourse of you know, Western European countries in this context and action, and how your research speaks to that.
I think precisely because these intelligence exchanges could be kept entirely secret, at least until a historian comes and digs these documents out, that secrecy allowed these covert relations between the West and Israel to be maintained. And absolutely, you know, towards the end of this assassination campaign, I mean, let's say it came to an abrupt end when Mossad thought that they had killed one of the assumed, you know, leaders of Black September organization. And in fact, they had killed a cleaner and a Moroccan cleaner and waiter who lived in Norway, had actually a wife that was pregnant 7 months. He just happened to look very closely very similarly to Ali Hassan Salameh. In any case, this sparked international crisis. The Norwegians were outraged. They had not, they said they didn't know about these assassinations. Even, you know, it was a internationally, like, the relations had bittered, and there was a outrage against Israel. But I really looked at that, the third part of my book really looks at the exchanges among the intelligence agencies, and it was absolutely nothing had changed. So you had this official level condemnation and secret level cooperation, business as usual. Even the police reports after assassinations were continuing to be shared with Mossad. So even on these specific cases, it was not just about Palestinians more broadly, even in specific cases where Mossad was involved, they continued sharing intelligence.
So I think for people hearing this, some people will be familiar with the context that you're talking about. Some people will not. So maybe you could just sort of go back and give us a bit of a picture of the time that you're talking about, and also why knowing about this period is important in the present context.
Okay. So let's have a delve into the 1970s and look at a watershed moment for international history, which is the Munich Olympics in 1972. It was meant to be a heitere Sommerfestspiele, as they say in German. It was meant to be a cheerful atmosphere in Munich. The German government on purpose had a very light security footprint. Also noteworthy is that the Palestinians have asked the Olympics committee to participate in the Olympics, and they were denied access to it. They said, well, you're not the country, so no, you're not joining. And that is said has given kind of the impetus for the Palestinians saying, well, we will join whether you want us or not. And they organized an attack. And so what happened is that a Palestinian group called Black September Organization had climbed up the fence. As I said, the security was very light there, and entered the Olympics and the Israeli Olympics team compound and took hostage. Took, I think, 11 hostages. And what happened is that the German government, wanted to lure them into a trap and said, yes, we will fly you out to Egypt and continue negotiations. But in fact, they had planned a rescue operation to free the hostages. And at that point, it went terribly foul. And all the hostages, so all the Israeli athletes, were killed. And everybody except for three Palestinians had survived. Everybody except for three Palestinians died as well. So only three had of the perpetrators had survived. And that a particularity of this event is that the world was watching. You know, the television had been recently been invented and had made its way into the households of people. So the world was watching the Olympics. And as the Palestinians carried out the hostage taking, the world was watching as well. There was, again, I think that was a shock for the Israelis in all genuinity. It was the pride of their athletes. They were going back to Germany after a long history, a very problematic history, obviously, post-war history also between Israel and Germany as West Germany as states. And the Israeli government said, well, we want revenge for that, what happened. And they knew that if they were to ask for extradition requests, the Arab countries would simply refuse. So they were saying, well, we will take justice in our own hands, you know. And so the Israeli leadership, Golda Meir in person, decided to initiate an assassination campaign. And first they wanted to find out who was this Black September organization. It was not well known at the time who they were. They wanted to find out who had allegedly been planning this Munich Olympics attack, and they wanted to hunt and kill everybody involved. And I mean, here we have difficult parallels to today's some of October attack. There's a comparable unit today. It's called the Neeli unit that also is in charge of finding out who was likely responsible and involved in the attack. And these people had also today are hunted down and killed in actually a very similar way than this happened in the 1970s. So this assassination campaign is today known as Operation Wrath of God. And what my book reveals for the first time is that the Israelis didn't do it alone. The Europeans were providing intelligence that helped locate these the Palestinians that were on a target list, help find out their routines, help find out their address simply, or what they were doing, and helped with the planning of the help with the planning of this assassination campaign. And as I hinted at earlier, it helped with signaling to Mossad that they will be that this will be tolerated from a European perspective.
A lot can be drawn from what you've shared. One point I think that could be interesting to talk about is sort of how an event like this changes the political parameters of what is understood as possible in the context of the Israeli state. And I think like drawing an understanding from that time to the present, where we've seen a move towards genocidal policies, which is a political decision that happened. And that decision doesn't take place in a vacuum. There's a series of events that have led to there being an understanding that on some political level, the Israeli state could continue to maintain relations with Western countries despite these things happening. Of course, I think it's always important to underline that these types of activities aren't exclusive to the Israeli state. There's a long history of targeted political assassinations tied to the French government, to the British government in terms of anti-colonial uprisings in Kenya, in the context of British occupation, or in India, or North Africa in the context of France. And obviously that's always important to underline, but we are talking about the Mossad and Western Europe state institutions. So sort of understanding this context, I think, and how it sort of plays a political role in the staging of now is probably important.
If you want to draw some more parallels between the 7th of October and the Munich Olympics in 72, I think both of them, as you say, changed the perception of what is possible, and it was, I mean, the. From the Israeli side, this was perceived as a legitimate reaction. I mean, Golda Meir was actually more like replying to requests from the Israeli society to do something to retribute these athletes who have been killed, to avenge them in a way. There was even an attempt. Somebody right after the Munich Olympics, an Israeli, thought that the government was not doing enough and actually tried to smuggle weapons himself to Europe to try to, plan an attack somewhat against Palestinians. And then I think the Israeli government was kind of reassuring him, like, no, we are taking care of that. But what I'm saying with that is that there was a hunger for, and there was a need to address this perceived injustice of what happened in Munich.
Political landscapes change in relation to such events, and what's deemed as permissible also changes in terms of like diplomatic relations and political possibilities. And so I was thinking about your research work in relation to how the political landscape changed after that event, and then also how there's a through line in relation to the work of intelligence agencies and information sharing from then until now. Of course, like it's important to underline, projects like the Five Eyes, I think, and learn more about institutions like that. I guess just to sort of end, could you just say the name of the book and also just share a bit as a historian why you took on this project? It's obviously a huge effort that I'm sure took many years. Why was this important for you to share now?
The book is called Operation Wrath of God: The Secret History of European Intelligence and Mossad's Assassination Campaign. Why is it important that I was there? I think it does shed light on, as you say, on a history that helps explaining current events as well. I think it shows to a certain degree an event, it sheds light on an event of the Munich Olympics attack in a similar way that the 7th of October has changed Israeli society forever, has impacted international relations, but it also sheds light on a secret level that is not often discussed. And that is equally important because this is oftentimes, where the realpolitik of international relations does happen, and therefore should be discussed as well and have a should open up further reflections that are also relevant for today. With whom are we currently sharing intelligence? Should we have a national debate about what kind of information is being shared with whom? Should there be a law that regulates intelligence agencies? Should they be free? And should there be criteria for only, sharing intelligence with democracies? But then where do you draw the line? So these are difficult discussions, but I do believe that the book kind of opens as well the doors to enter these debates and to think more about it.
Aviva, thank you so much. And I think, a lot of what you shared is also important for people who are hearing this in the Canadian context to think about how intelligence agencies have acted in a very repressive way towards Indigenous groups, for example, in Canada. So there's a lot of connections to be made, and understanding that can be drawn from the specific example that you look into, but as taking place globally. So thank you so much for the conversation today.
My pleasure.
That was a conversation with historian and author Aviva Gutman, author of Operation Wrath of God, The Secret History of European Intelligence and Mossad's Assassination Campaign. That is out through Cambridge University Press in the UK. Thanks so much to Aviva for being on the program today. I'm Stefan Christoph, and this has been another edition of Free City Radio. We broadcast weekly on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal on Wednesdays at 11 a.m., on CJLO 1690 a.m. also in Montreal on Wednesdays at 8 a.m., on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on Tuesdays at 8 a.m., on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston on Wednesdays at 11:30 a.m., on CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria on Saturdays at 7 a.m., on Met Radio 1280 a.m. in Toronto on Fridays at 5:30 a.m., on CKCU 93.1 FM in Ottawa on Tuesdays at 2 p.m., on CJSF 90.1 FM in Vancouver on Thursdays at 4:30 p.m., and on CHMA 106.9 FM in Sackville, New Brunswick on Tuesdays at 10 a.m. You can find our archives at soundcloud.com/freecityradio. We are also a podcast. Look us up. Just search Free City Radio. Thanks so much for tuning in, and I will speak to you next week.
Give me the time, I am bent over reading your empty reply. I am holding a sweater I thought I might buy, and then suddenly stop short and starting to cry. And my friend holds me close, says you'll never own up to the things that you're probably feeling inside. But either which way, I am crushed by your words, and I put back the sweater and wipe both my eyes and say, I deserve better, don't I? Don't I? I deserve better, don't I? Summer, I go to see you. I'm waiting outside on a wood picnic table. The gates, and you message me that it's been hectic backstage. You'll be out when you can. Such a bad guy. It's that I deserved better that time.
Jan with I Deserve Better.